Hey, Startup Hustle listeners, before we get into today's episode, I've got some exciting news to share. If you've enjoyed the insights and stories here at Startup Hustle, you're going to love what we have in store at our brand new podcast called Product Driven. I've always described myself as a product guy first, entrepreneur, software engineer, but really a product guy. I love building products. Many people struggle, though, with how to take a product idea and build a tech product, while software engineers struggle to understand the business side of things and they just don't see the big picture. My new podcast, Product Driven, is about that gap between business and the tech side of building software. It's designed for startup founders, tech leaders, software engineers, and anyone who loves tech and startups. Thank you for being part of this community. Enjoy this episode of Startup Hustle, and please subscribe to Product Driven in your podcast app, and you can also check it out on YouTube. Thank you so much.
And we're back for another episode of Startup Hustle, a podcast for entrepreneurs by entrepreneurs. If you want to start, own, or build a business, then you're in the right place. We bring you the real truth about what it's like to take something from concept to launch. From growth, innovation, experience, failing, or winning big, we've got you covered. So let's get down to business with another episode of Startup Hustle, brought to you by Fullscale.io. And we're back. Another episode of Startup Hustle. Matt DeCourcy here again to have another conversation that I'm hoping helps your business grow. Now, we're all chasing the dream. We're all looking to do something and build something that's bigger than us, or something that cashes a big check, makes a huge difference. The thing is, there's a lot that goes into that whole story. We're going to get into that today. Now, before we get too far, today's episode, Startup Hustle, is brought to you by Fullscale.io, helping you build a software team quickly and affordably. With me today, I've got Richard Lau, and Richard's currently the founder of Logo.com, a really amazing site that has generated over 10 million logos for business owners. It does a whole lot of stuff, but he's also the former founder and owner of Resume.com, which he led to a successful exit in 2017. We're going to talk about what it takes to get to that point. Richard, welcome to Startup Hustle.
Thanks very much, Matt. It's an honor to be here. I'm a big fan of the show.
And I appreciate the Canadian visit. So repping Vancouver today. So yeah, that's actually kind of early there, man. I got you up early. Sorry about that.
That's okay. It's not snowing yet. It's still only August. We're happy to be here.
So before we get into the meat and potatoes of today's show, why don't you give us a little bit about your backstory and what brought you to today's episode?
Certainly. I've always been an entrepreneur at heart. I did some crazy stuff when I was a teenager, you know, getting coupons from a local store and then selling them right outside the amusement park for cash. And, you know, just some fun, very much hustle-y type of things. But, you know, I went to university, graduated with a marketing degree and didn't really know what I was doing. And some friends, said, "Hey, let's sell beepers." I'm starting to age myself here, but sell nice beepers up here in Canada. And so we put together a little company. We were selling beepers. We were the first ones to do it. And, you know, we ran into cash flow problems, merged with traded PO purchase orders for jobs at a larger company. And then my former partner said, "Hey, you know, there's this internet thing." And so he went off and started up a dial-up ISP. And I came over and gave him some advice and some consulting on the side, just on the operational side. And I started to talk to some of his customer service reps who were dealing in domain names. And what they were doing is they had a couple of real estate agents who would call them and say, "Hey, I want to register Libya.com or weed.com," or, you know, they were just doing countries because that's, you know, location, 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 I guess, for real estate agents. And they were charging them $100 per domain to send in the email. And I was like, "Hey, I bet I could play around and figure out a way to do this online. And so I got a script together for $50, plugged it into another script that would send an email, talked to a guy who had domain name servers. And basically I scotch taped and strung a little website together. And it allowed people to search for and register domain names. And so that became a domain name registrar. And then, you know, it's like out of left field, I got hit by a bat, by a baseball in the side of the head. And, you know, I'm flying high, I'm doing six figures a month, and boom, I got diagnosed with colon cancer. And Yeah. And so, man, if that's not a kick in the head, it really changed the trajectory of my life. And so I was 30 years old. My son was 3 months old. We had just moved to a new country. And, you know, I basically, you know, long story short, I survived it. But I merged my company very quickly, without doing, doing an exit really, to a company in California. And, fast forward a year and I'm left with a severance check, and the $4 million company that I had 12 months prior has evaporated. So that's something that I think we could dig into. And then from there, I got back to Vancouver with my severance check and I'm like, man, what am I going to do now? And so I got back into domain names, buying and selling. And along the way, got to build my own portfolio of domains, and one at a time, we pull them out and develop them into real businesses. And so we did that with resume.com, 10 staff, local Vancouver office, a real live, profitable business, and sold that to Indeed, and did that with a conference business. And now we're doing the same with logo.com. It's a name we've owned for 7 years. But now we've got a local office, we've got staff, and we've been working on it for coming up on 2 years now.
So a quick question and congratulations on at overcoming adversity, because especially at a younger age that can, I've seen people that have just really not ever gotten back on track from a lot of that stuff. And, you know, like much like COVID did to us, the world has a tendency to throw some curveballs at you. And, you know, like, it's just, it recently my wife said something to me. She's like, how are you dealing with all this stress? I'm like, I've been an entrepreneur for a long time. I'm just kind of used to the yo-yo, you know, that up and down effect. So I have a question going back in the history a little bit. So with the domain names, Were you doing just registrar stuff, or were you, because at one point I knew a couple different people that, you know, early in the internet game, and I'm using air quotes there, were doing it like, oh, they might have own like birthdaycakes.com, and they had created some significant passive income from those things because they basically turn into just mini link directories. You don't see that as much now, but, you know, I'm looking back at your history and you were doing domain stuff in 2002, and almost 20 years ago, 10 years ago, it was still Wild West on the internet. 20 years ago, some people were still talking about how the internet was a fad.
Right. Well, I mean, you know, my last name is Lau, LAU.com, and people are like, oh, wow, you must have paid a lot for that name. And, well, actually, I hand registered it in 1996. So that's 24 years ago. So you can imagine, it was even crazier than the Wild West. I stayed up 3 days in a row, and I just kept sending. There was no system. It was just like some guy back east would run a delete script on names that hadn't been renewed, and I knew that Lau.com was coming up for expiration, but I didn't know when. And so my wife thought I was crazy, but I just stayed up and I just kept sending, you know, this was the days of TCP/IP and Winsock, you'd have to connect and, you know, anyway, yeah, I finally got it after 3 days. But so that's 1996, 1999 is when I actually started the registrar, Names Direct. and Domain Direct. And we, you know, we, yeah, it was an insane time, but it was just registering domain names. And I was so busy registering domains that I didn't take the time until after, you know, the disastrous exit, to see how these guys that I was registering names for, were actually making money, doing them. So I was the guy registering birthdays.com for people for $20. And so I was selling shovels instead of actually using the shovels myself.
Well, we've talked about that. And oftentimes in a gold rush, the people that make the most money are the people selling pickaxes and shovels, not right. actually out there mining for gold. Now, and for those, to give some context to some listeners that might be a little younger than we are, you know, a lot of people early in the internet, it was just very common to go to like birthday.com or weddingdresses.com or something like that. And there were people that were making significant passive income, because they would have thousands upon thousands of domain names sometimes, and they would just basically were serving up Google ads and different stuff. And that was a very common practice. Now, that said, you might not think about it. I knew several people that became millionaires from doing that, or from domain, just literally buying and selling domains. Now, it was once said that you should buy real estate because they're not making any more of it. Then they made the internet.
Yeah.
And that kind of cast a shadow on that. Now, as we're talking about, you know, preparing for an exit, let's talk about the one that didn't go that well. Because I, you know, as I talk to a lot of people that are seeking investment, everyone seems to want, they're very self-conscious about losing control or who they're going to partner with. And, you know, sometimes I think those concerns are they're a little overly cautious, but there's certainly situations like the one you mentioned where you're owning and you're running your company, and next thing you know, you're walking out the door with a cardboard box and a severance check on top of it. So, like, what were some things that in preparing for an exit, and that was an exit, maybe not the kind that founders are hoping for, but what were, and I don't want to get you in hot water, but what were a couple things that you learned from that experience that led you to the next one that was truly a successful exit?
Right. So, you know, I mean, I look back and I make the excuse of, oh, you know, I had cancer and I was, you know, dealing with that stress and I was distracted, et cetera, et cetera. But really, you know, if I had had better advisors, or if I had, you know, listened to anyone about, you know, how to do an exit instead of just blindly jumping in, you know, I think it would have been an entirely different story. But what some of the fundamental mistakes that we as a team made is that we shopped for our own purchaser. And so we didn't engage a business broker. So even if you do have your own purchaser in mind, it's still extremely valuable to bring in a business broker because they have done this, you know, 200, 300, 400 times. And, you know, you're dealing with your very first one, right? So it's like, you know, it's an imbalance that you need an advisor who is a professional in this. And so, yeah, sure, you're like balking at their fee, whether it's 5% or 10% or 15%, whatever that percentage is, they're going to earn it because your risk on not using them is a lot higher than that percentage. So the fact that we didn't use a business broker meant that we were going into this blind, you know. So we're, you know, just to give you an idea of the numbers, we're worth, say, $4 million, and they're worth 100, 120 million. And so, you know, already you're lopsided. And so the second thing is that we were going in as not an all cash deal. So it was part cash, part stock, part IOU. And so, you know, the cash was fine. You know, cash is king, right? So that, and for us, we had debts that we needed to pay. And, you know, that was, we had a tax bill, we had lawyers, those guys don't accept stock in a company. And so that was the cash deal. That was, that was, that took all of the cash that was part of the deal, is what I'm saying. So then you're left with a small IOU, and you're left with a, we were left with a small IOU and a stock. Now you're like, oh, great, I've got stock in this company. Now, wait a second, you're buying this stock. That's where we failed, is we didn't recognize that, hey, we, as much as these guys are doing diligence on us, we are doing diligence on them. And we kind of had the God factor, like, oh my goodness, you know, these guys are worth $100 million. You know, we don't really need to do due diligence on them. They've already made it. But they sent us over stacks of due diligence because, you know, of papers, because they're a big company. But buried in there is this equity investment from a billion-dollar company that has put money in, and it's basically they're investing money, but that money is then used to purchase services from that same company that is making the investment. And that company then has an option to purchase the company that's buying us for, you know, X hundreds of millions of dollars. Well, when you look at that, it's got, I don't know if your listeners remember, Enron written all over this thing, right? It's just, it stinks to high heaven. And if we had seen that in the due diligence, it would have given us pause. But we didn't see it. We didn't ask about it. If we had had a business broker, he would have gone through the due diligence. He would have found it, and he would have said, hey, guys, this is not right. And sure enough, after we had done the merge, the company that had this billion-dollar company that had this option to purchase looked at this and said, if we go through this, somebody's going to go to jail because, you know, this money that is invested in the target company gets kicked back to us. And then we're supposed to buy you guys based on that? Like, no, we're not, you know, this is our last phone call with you, and we want our money back. And then we find out that not only was that investment, that $30 million investment, it was a convertible debt. So they're now saying, hey, it's a demand loan. We've converted it from an investment into a demand loan. So now you owe us $30 million. And I'm sitting, you know, in my office, and I'm like, you know, the company that I've merged in with is suddenly doing a fire sale, and they're saying, hey, we need to sell stuff to pay off this loan. And they turn around and they're like, you know, the most valuable asset that we have now is the asset that Richard just vended in. So we're going to put that up for sale. And Richard, your debt is behind these guys, so you're not going to get paid anything. So that's,
I want to break that down for just and simplify it maybe a little more. So that convertible note that came in from the intermediate company. So you have Richard's company, you have the company that's acquiring them, and then you have the company that's invested in the company that's acquiring them. When you set up a convertible note that is set up to either convert into ownership of a company, or like he said, it could turn into, if you don't take that option or something doesn't automatically trigger it, then you're in a spot where you owe money. And a lot of times with convertible debt, it'll be triggered by different events or timeframes or stuff that could occur. But there are ways for whoever issued that to say, no, we actually now 2 or 3 years later, which is a typical gestation period on a lot of these things, they'll look at it and maybe they say, you know what? We don't really want to own stock in your company anymore for whatever reason. Now, in this case, it was at no fault to you, but it put you in that waterfall that was currently dropping very quickly on people's heads. And in that case, the middle company needed to do something to service the debt, making it very easy to say, well, look, we've got this guy's stuff. And when Richard's talking about position, and this is what you have to be very careful of, because there's a lot of times when you can see exits that occur and some investors get shut out completely. You would think that everybody that put money in would get X, Y, or Z, but often there's preference and payment terms, there's built-in returns, there's like a whole bunch of stuff that can basically take all the gold out of the leprechaun's chest prior to it making it down the line to you. And is that a fair summary of what occurred?
Absolutely, Matt. Thank you. Sometimes my wife says I rambled, but that's a perfect summary.
Exactly. Well, but honestly, that's the role I try to play sometimes, because it's just like, you know, look, this stuff's really confusing. And I remember my first go at this, and I had gone out to Manhattan, like in New York, Manhattan, and I was talking to some very sophisticated people, and I did an afternoon meeting the day that I got there, and I realized I was in way over my head after that meeting, and I'll never forget, because I stayed up that entire night, like pounding coffee and learning like everything that I needed to learn, because I was like, holy shit, I can't, because I'm used to doing stuff in my head. You know, and figuring it out. And so I had to like really teach myself the forward, backward, like all the different mechanics of like all this stuff, and did it like overnight. I showed up the next day and the guy that was hosting me, he was like, dude, what did you do last night? I was like, have you seen that scene in The Matrix where Neo plugs the, you know, I know Kung Fu now. And he's like, you might, but the thing is a lot of that stuff, it's very confusing, and understanding where you stand in the pecking order is a very important part of creating partnerships, because if you are preparing for, you lucky enough to, I say luck, but I don't believe in luck, or you work hard enough to get to an exit, it might not be everything you thought it was. So, okay. So not only do you not end up getting paid, you got fired.
So basically it
kind of, right?
Yeah, definitely. It was actually an all out battle. You know, it was a boardroom battle. I was integral to the asset, and they tried to sell it without me. And, you know, I basically had very difficult conversations where I threatened to do things that were not legal, but were moral. And they were doing things that were legal, but immoral. And, you know, I basically moved back to Vancouver, even though I was still working for them, had an office here, and they were trying to get me to quit. And they were trying to get me to accept 6 cents on the dollar. And, you know, they basically discovered that they could not sell the asset without me. And so we ended up getting, 30% of the value of what it was sold for, instead of, 6%. And so, but it's a far cry from number one, it was a fire sale. And number two, you know, what happened to that other 70%, right? So, for me, it was, an absolute disaster, right? It was really a 90% loss of what I had owned a year prior. But yeah, it was definitely an exit. You know, I had my cardboard box, and what was surprising to people in my circle is they're like, oh wow, you know, you're back from California, you did the big tech thing, you know, rah, rah, rah. And you're like, dude, I lost it all, right? And you know, even my severance check, I had to split with my partners. So, you know, I came back and I was like, oh my goodness, what am I going to do? Right. I've got my son is now 1 year old. We're back in Vancouver. I don't have a job. The last company I built was a disaster. Where do I start? And so just like the friend that you were talking about, I jumped into both feet with buying and selling domain names as a broker and setting them up with Google Ads. And, that's what I did for the next 10, 12 years. Working from home, I was like, I don't want to have three offices around the world and work 100 hours a week. I want a lifestyle, right? I don't even care about building something that I can sell. I just want a lifestyle that I can spend time with my family, work from home, and have fairly low stress, relative to working 100 hours a week, but still, you know, not the same kind of stress as, low stress as just having a job. So it was still an entrepreneurial, it was still, you know, eat what you kill. But it was about a dozen years of buying and selling domain names and building up a domain portfolio.
What brought you to resume.com? Like what, you know, now I'll tell you that one of the things that with a resume or an often outside the US often referred to as your CV, your curriculum vitae, is it vitae or vitae?
Yeah.
I don't know. I have a couple hundred employees in the Philippines and they don't know what a resume is. That's always CV, but I've learned, you know, over the last 20 years, I've hired hundreds of people at this point, whether it was for another company I work for or for my own. And, you know, the struggle is real with the resume, and people aren't very good at representing themselves. So, you know, and the history of this is, you know, you're getting into this in 2013. Now, 2013 doesn't sound like a long time ago. This was still like, okay, so I saw Skype came out in 2009. That's when it first started getting used, you know, and like you look at some of the dating, some of these things, and, you know, I often compare. So I started my first business out of the extra bedroom of my home, and people are like, well, 2009, that's not long ago. I'm like, okay, that was iPhone 2. You know, and like you then all of a sudden they're like, oh my God, that was forever ago. So, I mean, I'm assuming that you picked up resume.com somewhere in the domain brokerage and buying phase. Is that how that began?
Yeah. So a partner approached me and said, hey, I see resume.com is up for sale and that resumes.com is probably also acquirable. You know, are you interested in buying this together and let's build a business? And so we actually, because we're in the business of buying and selling domains, we see lots and lots of domains coming across. And, you know, not every one is something that you want to develop a business into. Indeed, you know, most of them are not. But with Resume, we could see what a clear path for building a business, you know, building a resume builder, how people would use it, how we could monetize it. And so we bought the names within 6 months of each other. And, you know, it costs us well over seven figures, well into the seven figures. And, you know, but we then started to build a resume builder. And it's kind of like the ignorance of, you know, you think it's just, you know, a few forms. And, you know, if you're doing it now.
Down the rabbit hole.
Absolutely.
But by the way, I want to talk about something real quick, because you bought resume and resumes.com. Now, I know why, because I've learned a similar lesson. So I'm the founder of Gigabook and I launched Gigabook.com. And when we started telling people about it, they'd be like, I'm going to Gigabooks and I don't see your site. And like more people were telling us that than they were, hey, we found your site. And I bought Gigabook.com for $500 and I was like, fuck, this is like a great deal. This is awesome. And then I had to pay five times more for Gigabooks.com only to redirect it to Gigabook.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean,
and that's why you bought the plural version too, right?
That's exactly it. Yeah. Because, you know, when you're, one of our earlier sites was called My Domain, and I would be speaking with people and they would refer to it as My Domains. And, you know, you couldn't, it's just like, you know, it's easier to buy the plural than it is to
which is often harder than you think. Cause here's the thing is like in some of that, like I had to kind of gently slide in to make it an offer for that. Cause I knew if that seller knew I owned gigabook.com, then they could feel like they had me over a barrel.
Right.
And, absolutely. You know, I mean, they were already asking a lot more. Like I said, I went from thinking, and that was nowhere near what you're paying for those domains. But I mean, when you think you got a great deal on something for $500 and then you find out you got to spend several grand just to buy a domain that you're only going to, you know, these are the things that you learn along the way that might not seem obvious to some, but, oh, I look back at it, I'm like, shit, why didn't I think of that?
Right. I mean, you know,
what you're trying to avoid is a competitor that's resumes.com that does the exact same thing you did, right?
Exactly. And, you know, when you're talking about planning for an exit, your domain name strategy is and branding strategy is part of that plan. Because even if you see, you know, a lot of people see a domain name and they see that it's listed for sale and like, oh, those domain squatters, blah, blah, blah. You know, hey, no, that is an opportunity. Because if you see a domain, let's say, you know, you're starting as gigabook.com But you're, but it's for sale for 5,000, and gigabooks.com is for sale for 50,000, but you could start with gigabook.co for registration fee, right? So let's say it's 50 bucks. And so, you know, you have this progress here. You can say, okay, I'm going to start my minimal viable product on gigabook.co for 50 bucks. And once I see that it's going, I'm going to buy gigabook.com for 500. And then once that I'm going, then I'm going to graduate and I'm going to buy gigabooks.com, you know, the plural. So you can have this progress. But if one of those is owned by a competitor, then what are you going to do, right?
Or someone that just wants a stupid price.
Yeah. Yes.
I mean, like that happened. Like I did that with one of a different book that I published, and I can't remember what the domain was, but you know, I wanted it for my book, and I reached out to the seller. And he's like, "I want $50,000," and I was like, "Really? Like this isn't even like a good like it was like a nine letter. It was right. I couldn't see where it was coming from, but yeah. You know, like you said, as I think that what you just mentioned is like not the right strategy because you don't have control over that. You can't guarantee. So in my book, Million Dollar Bedroom, So Dick's Sporting Goods.
Yeah.
This is kind of a laughable thing. So people would, if you went to Dick's.com, it certainly was not Dick's Sporting Goods. Right. Those men were not playing the kind of sports that you wanted to buy shoes for. So, yeah. You know, and I don't know what I can only imagine like that had to be a massive issue for that chain. They acquired it eventually. But yeah. I mean, here's the thing is when you only have one buyer and one seller, like that's not an auction. That's not that's two people and two entities trying to find an amicable thing. And like, here's the thing is like in the Dick's.com case that was a male porn site.
Yeah.
And they probably made a hell of a lot more money off of selling that domain to the sporting chain than they did off of the website.
Yeah.
Because in that case, you're like, hey, I'll take my time. I'll just hold on to it. Like how much longer do you want to be embarrassed?
So, right.
All exactly. Right. So with resume, you know, and you go into starting this and now up to this point, you had been a domain broker and done a lot of different things. And now, like you mentioned, I think that you said a couple things why I commented, and down the rabbit hole. It's easy to look, especially in 2013, it was easy to be like, oh, we're just going to build a couple things. And you know, like it'll probably take like 2 months and then we won't have to do anything again. Because I'm used to passive income and I won't have to do anything. And like software is done and you can finish it and it won't be hard. And I have a feeling you learned that that wasn't the case. Is that true?
That was so not the case. We ended up building three versions of the website over 7 years. And each time you're building a new version, you're literally throwing the old one away.
Yes. Yeah.
And each one costs hundreds of thousands of dollars. It was an incredible learning experience and an expensive one. But we delivered a fantastic experience to our end users. I also exited while we were building resume, I also exited a conference that I started and sold. And that gave me that going through the due diligence of selling the conference gave me an insight of, hey, this is what people are going to want to see when they're buying resume. So it actually gave us the ability to say, hey, you know, when we're building this third version, let's make sure we do this. Let's make sure we do that. Let's make sure we get it.
What are a few of those things? What are a couple of like the main things?
That a buyer wants to see. It's not that it's not the Wild West. That you have a what's called a data room that contains all of the contracts, all of the licensing. Are you paying for everything that you're supposed to be paying for? You know, you've got 10 employees. Are you paying? Does your license show that you have 10 employees? You know, it's not that like, hey, you know what? If I can be sneaky here and save $15 a month by claiming that I've got 8 people instead of 10, you know, that's going to come out from the due diligence of the purchaser. And they're going to be like, you know, that's not good. You know, there's a risk factor there that one of your employees is going to whistleblow on you. And as part of a risk factor, we're going to mark that down and we're going to reduce that out of the purchase price. So, you know, kind of taking shortcuts is going to bite you in the butt when you're going through the due diligence, when you're actually doing an exit. So making sure that you're not cutting corners, making sure that you've got all of your contractor agreements in place, all of your employment agreements in place, that you're, you know, avoiding all lawsuits, you know, that you're, you know, that you're being a good and decent corporate citizen, because it's all going to come out in the wash. Every skeleton that you think is buried is going to come out in the wash. And in the due diligence, and any skeleton that exists or may exist is going to affect the purchase price. And so conversely, everything that you do right is going to protect your asking price. So when you're putting your leases in place, when you're putting your software licenses in place, everything that you're doing right is not an exercise in futility. You know, when you're doing admin work and you're like, oh my goodness, why am I filling in this stupid government form, or why am I doing this this paperwork? You're doing that for your potential purchaser. You're not just doing it to have it done. And so having those data points ready for your potential purchaser, it's a lot easier to do along the way. You've got this in mind, even, you know, when you're not, when you don't have a purchaser or an exit, in place, you're just, you know, you're planning for this future wedding, you know, it's very vitally important to be able to protect your asking price.
So a data room is a term that some will be familiar with and some might not, but a data room, there are actual platforms that can help you do a data room. And then honestly, man, like I've in the past, I just use a Google Drive.
Yeah, exactly.
And some of that, I mean, it's that simple, and like some certain things that you'll commonly find. So I'll tell you that. So at Full Scale, where we're not seeking outside investment, we still update our own data room about once a quarter. Because we never know when we're going to need that stuff. Like if you need a bank loan or you need anything else. And the thing is like the sum of all the parts equals a lot of time, bandwidth, and energy. So if you feel like you can just literally have a couple people at your business drop everything that they're doing to get your data room up to speed, then go ahead and wait. But it's best to keep it going. So certain things, you'll see like basic corporate documents, certificates of incorporation, and like capital stock, security, financial statements, tax returns showing you don't have like a massive tax liability, that you've actually filed your taxes, properties and assets, things related to intellectual property, any trademark documentation you might have, assets and liabilities, which is a cap table, who actually owns your business, what investors may have unexercised options. Oftentimes they're going to want to see information like, you know, at Full Scale, and once again, today's episode of Startup Hustle is brought to you by FullScale.io. We don't service a huge number of clients, but if we, in our data room, we have to be prepared to say who they are, what percentage of our business is per client, because having one client that's 50% of your revenue is not attractive. And just like a whole lot, it goes on and on and on. Now, here's the thing is, if you have to stop what you're doing and prepare this, like, dude, you can literally do that. It's going to stop your business. And so keeping that kind of this same information is going to be needed or necessary in a lot of different cases. It could even be needed just to like upgrade the insurance policy at your business or something else. Like, and maybe you want to get a bank loan. Maybe you want to do just a couple different things. And so now here in the US, when we did PPP, the stimulus relief, we had our shit ready. So right. We were like first in line because we were ready. We had been prepared. And you know, that's important stuff. So if you don't, and here's another thing, let's just say whether it's an exit or an investment, not having any of that stuff ready also it's a little bit of a red flag. Like, hey, can we get your financials? You're like, yeah, soon. Yeah. Do you agree?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. We were just talking, having a family discussion about business, and I can't remember. I think it was Van Halen was one of those early touring bands, you know, and they had a Full Scale band show, you know, stage show. and they had in their contract, you know, all of the things that needed to be done. And it's a safety, you know, they got pyro. And one of their clauses was, you know, in the dressing room, the M&Ms, they couldn't have any of the brown M&Ms. And the people were like, oh, they're
green M&Ms. Yeah.
Well, really, it was a signal. It was like, hey, if we go into the dressing room and there are brown M&Ms there, that means that we need to delay the show by 2 hours and we need to go over every safety feature within the stage setup. So, you know, if someone says, hey, you know, if you're a purchaser and you're like, hey, you know, can you send me over your financials? And the guy's like, let me put them together. Then you're like, come on, that's a brown M&M. You know, it's easier to stay out than to get out.
Funny story with that. We have a funny story. When Startup Hustle made it onto the top charts for entrepreneurship podcasts, my often co-host and business partner, Matt Watson, I was joking about him making rock star demands. And he mentioned 4 pounds of green M&Ms.
Yeah.
One of you out there sent us 4 pounds of green M&Ms, and we still don't know who. It was an anonymous gift that showed up at our office, and we're like, oh wow, and no one has claimed that to date. So yeah, it's a real thing. But you're talking about that attention to detail, and what you're referring to is a writer. And you know, musicians are notoriously bad for having weird stuff on it or being really easy about it. So
right,
okay. So you know, the building three websites, that I've been down that road, that's not uncommon. The code that you have that your MVP is comprised of will probably not exist in a few years, either because you didn't make it or you had to remake it. So now as resume grows and you're gaining traction and growing it, you know, like at what point did you realize that you were onto something that might have an exit value?
You know, we went into it with an exit in mind. We didn't go into it as a lifestyle business. We didn't go into it as, hey, let's build something that we're going to keep for 10, 15 years. We went into it with, hey, what can we build and when can we exit? And it actually took us longer to exit than we anticipated. But, you know, from the very start, we were looking at the business from a potential buyer's point of view. And we were looking around and saying, okay, look, we can see that there are competitors in this business. We're going to make a product that is as good. It doesn't have to be better, but it's as good as our competition. And we will win because we have a better brand. You know, resume.com does what it says on the box, right? It's not resume garden, right? It's not resume direct. It's not resume buckets. It's resumes.com. And so that little bit of inertia that gives you that bit of an edge, you know, if someone is looking at these two things and they're like, oh, should I build my resume on resume garden or should I build it on resume.com? Well, I'll go with resume.com. They look the same,
right?
Even if the pricing is identical. So then we're like, okay, what can we do to give additional edge, right? How do we make our product better? We decided, let's be the Zappos because, you know, money back guarantee. You know, so we were a freemium service. So 1.5% of our customer base was actually paying. 98.5% were just free. So on that 1.5%, our competitors were exactly the same, but they would make it extremely difficult to stop paying the subscription fee. And whereas we were like, you know what, that's not worth it. We don't want a negative review. So if someone wasn't happy,
or thousands of chargebacks,
right? Exactly. So, yeah. If someone wasn't happy, we'd just give them their money back. You weren't happy 3 months in, give you all 3 months back. And so, you know, in even still, we knew that we were being helpful to the 98.5% with a money back guarantee. We knew we were delivering value to our 1.5%, and we knew we were delivering a product that was as good or better than our competitors. And so then Google starts to recognize that, and they start to say, hey, you know, we didn't do any black hat, nothing gray on search engine optimization. For the first 5 years, we didn't pay for any PPC. We didn't pay for any advertising. We were just focused on organic growth. And, you know, it worked. And when we really realized that we had something is that we did A/B testing on our pricing, and it didn't matter what we charged, people would still upgrade and pay for our product. So, you know, that was a real eye opener for us, because I was like, for that value, you know, we can only really charge like $5 a month. And so we did A/B testing. We tried it at $5, $9, $15. And we tried it at what our competitors were charging, which was $30. And it didn't really matter which price point we picked. Our revenue stayed roughly the same. So, you know, at a higher price point, fewer people would upgrade, but it would still be the same amount of revenue. And so we're like, hey, we're definitely delivering value here. And, you know,
So these are all science experiments. Was proving that theory out valuable as you approach the exit?
You know, it was valuable for us as a team, because it enabled us to continue to bootstrap. It wasn't valuable to the purchaser, because they looked at this as a complete lead gen website, and they weren't interested in the revenue whatsoever. So when they were looking at it...
That was my next question. Were they interested in the users, the people that signed up, or the revenue? So it was in fact that they wanted to drive people in. Did we mention earlier who bought this from you?
I don't think we did. It was Indeed.com. And it was actually in 2018, not 2017. That was my mistake. You know, time flies by. Indeed.com, you know, they're a very large job board, and they generate their revenue from the employers looking to hire, not from the job seekers. So when they looked at our property, they looked at it as search engine rankings. They're looking at it as the number of customers in the database. You know, I don't think they even really cared, like you said, about the stack, the software stack that we used, right? Because they've got their own expertise. But, you know, for us, just coming back to looking at it from the exit point of view, when we were looking at potential purchasers, it was vitally important to us as a team that our team go with the purchaser. So we had a purchaser who was looking at us and said, you know, we're going to just redirect your website over to ours. And, you know, we're going to get rid of this, you know, Zappos style, because we like making people jump through hoops, and we're going to fire everybody. So you'd need to fire everyone before we bought the you know, on transition, and we'll pay more. And we said, no, we turned down more money. You know, we're not Wall Street. We're, you know, we built a family. And really, it was vitally important to us, to the point that we put our money where our mouth is. We took less money from Indeed so that they would take our entire team of 10 people. Because, you know, even if I never see them again, those are 10 families that we had worked with over the years you know, it was important to us that, you know, not just to have money in the bank, but to have a good outcome from it.
Yeah. And, you know, a lot of that, I mean, and you're right about that a lot. It's just the interest, the reasons that bigger companies acquire smaller ones are all over the place. And, you know, Matt Watson sold Vint Solutions. And at the time, Vint Solutions had, you know, that was a $150 million exit. And they had 5 different products. They quit using 4 of them and just stuck with one. And, you know, they were interested in the revenue. That was very significant. But really, it was so big companies acquire small ones. Oftentimes, like with resume, that drives people into a bigger platform. So these different verticals, and you look at like, okay, we're going to acquire this. Yes, it's a tool that could help people make resumes to help them get jobs and find success on our platform. But how much would it cost to find all these users and introduce them themselves? And, you know, like it's not uncommon for companies to, all right, so some of these things that you see that do price comparison and shopping, like you might see an airline buy one of them because it's cheaper to acquire it than to keep paying the affiliate fee and different stuff. So there's a lot of weird reasons when things start scaling up. Now, as you exited to Indeed, were you careful to not relive the past agony that you had gone through?
Yes, absolutely. It was an all cash deal. There was no stock. There was an earnout, so you know there was funds.
Well, let's explain what that is.
Yeah, so the, and it was a simple earnout for us. It was basically a certain percentage of the purchase price gets held in escrow at a law firm, and as long as you do as the seller, you do certain things. And certain actions, you know, don't come out of the woodwork, like a lawsuit or a claim from an employee, you know, just as long as nothing bad comes to light, then, you know, a year or 2 years later, the money is then released. And that can be done on a different schedule. It can be done quarterly or 6 months or right on the anniversary. And it can be, you know, the earnout can be over several years. For us, we had a fairly short earnout of 1 year. And a very easy targets to hit, in that we just needed nothing bad to come out of the woodwork, right? So they're saying, look, when you're selling as a company, you're signing representations and warranties saying, hey, we represent that the following, and we warranty that, you know, the following. And so, you know, they need some type of a guarantee, so they like to hold back some of that purchase price to make sure that those things are what they say they are.
And now another question. I've talked to a lot of people that have had successful exits, and they describe it as anticlimactic, meaning like, you know, you have all this like excitement going up to it, and then you sign some papers. The next day there's money wired into your bank account, and then you're kind of like, okay, what do we do now?
Yeah.
You know, you're in this earnout phase, and an earnout's also to keep stability. Like you're, especially if you're like the CEO or the founder or the leader, if all of a sudden you're just gone, like you're kind of like a living, breathing, walking owner's manual, you know, in some regards, and that stability, and you might be the face of the brand, you know, it's your job to hand that over. Now, Ryan Reynolds, the actor, last week had a pretty successful exit with a tequila company, and he made a really funny post. He's like, so I just learned what an earnout is, and for all of you that I told to F off yesterday, I take that back. Which I don't know if he was serious about that, but it was like, I kind of picture that part in Half Baked where the guy quits the Burger King. He's like, F you, F you, F you, you're cool, and I'm out. And then you realize you need to stick around for a year. You're like, okay. Well, once again, with us today, Richard Lau. Richard's the founder of a lot of different things, currently logo.com. Now, I want to say that you have a counter on logo.com, and it's just been open on a browser since we started, and several hundred people have made a logo at logo.com during this podcast, including me. I checked it out, and I thought it was pretty cool. Now, you mentioned bands earlier. Sometimes finding a name for your business and picking a logo is as difficult as determining what your band name is, which many musicians will tell you is the hardest part of the whole entire story. So logos are tricky, and you know, something like logo.com can help you with that. Now, and thanks for joining, Richard. This is, I think these kind of real stories about the path and the road are important. We're going to wrap up with what we call the founder's freestyle. Is there a minute of advice that you can give any founder that wants to follow in the footsteps that you've gone down or gone through?
You know, I mean, there's been a couple sayings from my former bosses. One has been a lifesaver for me, which is it's easier to stay out than to get out. You know, as entrepreneurs, we often say yes when we should be saying no. And then the other is to young people, which is build your network. You know, get your LinkedIn profile up, reach out to people. You know, everyone's human, right? One of the driving factors is to be significant, and it's not all about the money. It's all about, you know, what impact can you have? Can you be helpful? And so one of my sayings is, you know, I'm here to be helpful, and you know, reach out if you're a startup and you're like, dude, I can't afford $20 for a logo. Reach out, hit me up. I'm Richard at logo.com. Chances are, you tell me your story, I'll give you a free logo. Right? Just ask, reach out. And you know, when you see Matt and you're like, hey, I'm going to send him 4 pounds of M&Ms, and then I'm going to call him for some advice. You know, you might be in university, might be in high school. Just reach out. you know, just don't hesitate. And I wish I had done that when I was young, and I wish I had someone tell me to do that, because man, I look back and I'm like, oh, that was a missed opportunity. That was a missed opportunity. That was a missed opportunity. Just build your network, see what you can do to help others in your network, and just, you know, yeah, be helpful.
I think that's all great advice. And I think one thing that I'd like everyone listening to take note is, like Richard said, don't be afraid to ask. Because here's the thing. So I'm 45 years old. And when I was 25, I was asking and people were taking an interest in me and giving me information, mentorship, advice, like stuff that some of which I didn't even fully process or understand till years later. But it stuck with me. And the thing is those, someone did that for those people. And knowledge isn't something that's meant to be kept. It's meant to be passed on. It's meant to be transferred. And much like the story of the village elder that passed the history of the tribe down from years to years to years, entrepreneurs and founders are the same way. Like, I've been in your seat. I've been in your boat. I know what it's like. And someone helped me out. And really, in the end, it's so much easier to ask those that are on top to pull you up than try to climb up by yourself in many cases. And there's always someone that is in a position to pull you up. Now, they have a decent vantage point to kick you in the face and watch you roll back down, but you're going to find that's not really what people are doing. So overall, well, Richard, thank you so much for sharing the story. If those of you out there get a chance, go to logo.com, make a logo, reach out to Richard. I found him on Facebook. He protects his connection request, but he gave you his email. So if you go back and figure that out, you can send that on. So anyway, I'll see you next time, Richard.
Thanks, Matt.
Startup Hustle is brought to you by Fullscale.io, helping you build a software team quickly and affordably. Make sure you reach down and hit that subscribe button, then come find us on Instagram. See you next time. We do it.